Well, I would say that generally all civilian casualties in Gaza were a direct consequence of Hamas's use of civilian areas, residences, hospitals, mosques, and so on, to fight this battle against the Israelis. And of the actual figures involved, it would appear that something like 700 of the fatalities are actual Hamas personnel, gunmen, bombers, engineers, foot soldiers, if you like. The remainder, so we're talking about things 300 to 400, would appear to be actual civilians. And as I say, they would really, you know, overall be regarded, as I think, as the victims of the policy of using human shields, basically fighting from behind civilians for cover.
Now, whenever the issue of civilian casualties comes up, the Israeli officials always tell the media that Israel regrets civilian deaths. But in your latest opinion piece, you appear to be arguing that Israel needs to go in harder, because you write, when a nation prefers missing its targets rather than inadvertently hitting civilians, it's lost the ability to defeat terrorists who use human shields. That, of course, was always the terrorists' aim, to make the spectre of civilian losses so terrible that those equipped with a conscience and rule book would give up the fight.
Well, yes, yeah, that's exactly correct. What the Israelis did here, I think, learning very much from their experience of dealing with Hezbollah in 2006 in the South Lebanon War, whereby they faced identical tactics, that is to say, the use of the civilian population of particular areas in which to shield their own forces and rockets and weaponry, they've made a pinpoint targeting and the use of very, very good intelligence a mainstay of their campaign. I think this was successful to the extent that it's hard to imagine this kind of warfare being prosecuted by any country in which you'd actually get the kind of ratio that I suggested, which was about 7-3, 7 terrorists killed against 3 civilians out of 10, if you want to put it in terms of averages. So the Israelis, I think, learned very well how to do that and were able to target a great deal of the Hamas personnel. Firstly, seizing surprise, the assault was unanticipated on the Hamas side. And secondly, in having very precise intelligence and knowing where to go and where to go after. And that had the corollary effect of being able to telegraph ahead to civilians in particular areas where areas were going to be targeted to get out of the area. Leaflets were dropped and so on. It seems to have been effective to quite a great extent, because it's very easy to imagine far, far higher civilian losses in this kind of in a battle of this kind of magnitude.
Now, there are some journalists who are brave enough to report from conflict zones, but Israel won't let foreign journalists into Gaza. As a result, most of the television footage that we saw during the height of the conflict was official footage filmed by the Israelis. Inevitably, that will have some people arguing that Israel was simply trying to avoid scrutiny.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the argument that's already been heard in a number of quarters. By the way, it's not entirely correct either, in as much as quite a big deal of the camera crews that were already there were part of Palestinian camera crews and larger media organizations, and they were able to get out their videotapes. And in this world of high-tech and amazing communications, it's very hard, I think, to keep a place entirely under wraps, and I don't think the Israelis either thought they could do that, and if they did, they certainly didn't succeed. But I don't think the picture was in any way changed from the public relations point of view. The fact of the matter is Western publics generally see the last effect. They don't see the earlier. They don't see the hundreds of missiles being fired into Israel over a period of 8 years and 250,000 Israelis running to bunkers sometimes twice a day in the southern part of Israel. But when you have a dramatic military confrontation in Gaza, and the pictures and videos do get out, people focus on that. And this war, I think, was no different.
But weren't people focusing on official government Israeli footage? That's what was playing in Australia on the ABC and SBS.
Well, I didn't see the Australian footage, so it's very hard to say. I can tell you that over here, one certainly did see footage emerging from the Palestinian side as well.
In your article, you go on to say, quote, "Guns rule in Gaza, and only their replacement by bigger guns can break Hamas's hold on the population." I'm wondering, though, what you think about white phosphorus shells. They appear to have been used by Israel in Gaza, And there are allegations that Israel has used these weapons in civilian areas contrary to international law.
Well, let's get the law right, firstly. Phosphorus weapons are prescribed by international law. Israel says it never uses them, and it's my understanding that they did not use them in Gaza. There were reports out and allegations made by a number of Palestinian organizations that, in fact, there were traces of phosphorus found here and there and so on. I noticed that even a number of the NGOs that are characteristically not known to be particular friends of the Israelis denied that this was the case, or that they had evidence that this was the case. Where confusion could honestly have arisen is the fact that phosphorus is an element used as an illuminator in warfare. Sort of a little bit like tracer bullets are used by machine gunners to illuminate a target or a direction of fire. And those were certainly used, but that is legal usage. The actual use of dense phosphorus bombs, I understand, was not in fact the case. And there is indeed a great literature already written on this current conflict already showing that in fact there is no evidence to actually back up those allegations.
Isn't Israel on record as saying that it may have used these phosphorus weapons and it's now subject of an internal investigation?
Well, specific allegations were made, and I understand there are investigations still ongoing, but the response from the Israeli command that we saw at the time when these allegations were made indicated that they had no policy of using these and weren't intending to. And I think for fairly obvious reasons, I mean, there's no particular advantage to be gained in any case from the Israeli point of view in using them, while conversely, there's a great public relations disaster in the making if it's found that they did. I would very much doubt, I don't obviously have positive knowledge to this effect, but I would very much doubt that the Israelis would be using those weapons.
So when Human Rights Watch makes that allegation, presumably you would dismiss it?
I would. Human Rights Watch does have a very long record of a number of unsubstantiated allegations against the Israelis, and I have seen this taken up, including by the NGO Monitor in Israel. I believe Professor Gerald Steinberg has been in communication with Human Rights Watch, as well as publishing a number of pieces on this subject, indicating precisely what the situation is and where Human Rights Watch actually gets it wrong.
What then do you make of the appointment of George Mitchell, the new Middle East envoy? He's on record as saying that there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Presumably, that sort of positive thinking on the part of Mitchell must augur well when it comes to the intractable Middle East conflict.
Well, permit me to give you a different view. Senator George Mitchell, former American senator, he has experience of conflict negotiations. He was involved in the 1998 Northern Ireland Good Friday Agreement, for example. And early on in the Israeli-Palestinian hostilities of 2000, he was appointed in the dying days of the Clinton administration to head an investigative panel, which reported it ready in George Bush's term. So he's the author of the Mitchell Report. I see it that his experience in a very different Irish case may actually be a drawback. As you said, he believes there's no such thing as an irresolvable conflict, yet I see no applicability in the Irish case. The IRA, unlike the Palestinian movement, never sought the other side's elimination. Its violence is not religiously inspired, and negotiations followed its military failure. Now, none of that applies here. So, Ireland, the Irish case, I think, is inapplicable. The problem, more specifically, going to this area that I see with, if one looks back, we have the Mitchell Report from 2001, so we can see, we have a window into Mitchell's thinking. The key defect that I see in it is that he assumes, contrary to statistic and polling evidence, that Palestinians generally accept Israel's existence and simply wish to negotiate the establishment of a Palestinian state alongside it. That is not actually the case. There wasn't incidentally the case at the time when he said that either. You know, I could quote you a legion of statistics on that. 54% of Palestinians have been shown to reject the idea of a two-state solution, so-called. According, that was in a poll in September last year by Annunja University. 58% were found to reject the idea as well a few months earlier. I can show you other polls that show that three-quarters of Palestinians don't think Israel has a right to exist. So when you have this kind of idea, it's very hard to come along and say that, in fact, as George Mitchell does, and he said this explicitly as recently as a month ago, that he believes the Palestinians are simply after a state of their own. If you base policy on a fallacy of that kind, you're bound to be disappointed. And that's where I see the problem. A plan for renewed negotiations that requires ignoring the Palestinian goal to eliminate Israel, either in the short term or in the long term, and which demands more Israeli concessions before the Palestinian Authority has actually fulfilled its Oslo obligations to act on terror and put an end to the incitement to hatred and murder, which actually fuels the conflict, such a policy is bound to make the conflict worse. And all indications are, for the moment, as I see it, that Mitchell will pursue something along precisely such lines.
Do you hold out any hope for the Middle East? Is there anything for you to feel positive about?
Well, I think there's a few things that one can say that are positive. But, I mean, I don't want to give an unnecessary optimistic picture either, because I think the all Greeks are bad. I think there are a number of irresolvable conflicts in the Middle East at the moment, and that they probably will issue in violence as time goes on, before things will get worse in many cases, before they get better. But it's very important in that situation not to do things that actually have the effect of making conflicts that are already bad worse. So I think I'm worried about the idea of renewed negotiations as though nothing had happened along these lines in the past few years, because at each stage, things seem to go better for a while, but it's followed by bloodshed and disappointment, and then there's more fury and more anger, and a lot of it gets directed at the Americans, who are actually trying to do something about it. So I see this as a losing game for the Americans. I don't see it benefiting Palestinians in as much as they therefore find themselves in no position to move forward to the hard choices of jettisoning their rejection of the Israelis and then coming to the idea of an actual solution with them. And of course it doesn't benefit the Israelis, who find themselves under continual pressure and hostilities for further concessions, when of course they're not in a position to make concessions that will actually lead to peace. So you have diminishing returns on all sides.